Hello and welcome to episode 38 of WB40, the weekly tech podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. Mr. Weston, pleasure to be in your presence again. How are you doing?
Well, Mr. Ballantyne, I'm very well, thank you. I'm somewhat jaded after quite a long week, but yes, very well. After we went out and about last week, didn't we, for our podcast, and that was all a bit frightening. I mean, I'm glad to be that we're back in our accustomed places now.
Exactly, we're back to recording on the same night and into our own personal spaces, rather than the somewhat overwhelming environment of the BBC's broadcasting house, and in your case, John Humphrey's chair.
Well, I thought it would be absolutely right for me to sit in it and keep it warm, because he's got to retire soon.
Surely. That's it. It's a seat designed for a big ass, and you've got the ass to fill it.
Well, I don't know. That's nothing. That's quite cutting. I try to fill these things as best I can. But no, I was. Wasn't it good? It was a great venue, a great guest in Zoe, who talked very interestingly about the sort of evolution of tech journalism. One of my favourite episodes so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting the difference it made being actually in person for both you and I, but also with the guest as well. That I think that it's easy to forget sometimes that when we use digital channels to be able to mediate between us in conversation, it does take something away. There's something about the being in person with people, especially with people you don't know. I think you and I have kind of got this down to a bit of a random ramble now, but for people that you don't know, to be able to actually be there and to be able to see the whites of their eyes and all of that does make a heck of a difference to how quickly you can get to be able to have a meaningful conversation with them.
Yeah, that's right. And then I went on a long and arduous journey to Eastern Europe, to Moldova, where I partook in a developer conference, being a bit of a development expert as I am. But that was good. That was good fun. And now I'm back. What sort of a week do you have yourself, Matt?
Started some work with a new client. It was very exciting. So there's a company that is in the world of community platforms, I think it's the best way to describe them, but we're just at the early stages of me and another chap working with them, which is really interesting, because they're a startup who've got to a certain stage and now looking to be able to say which way do they go now, and it's so some interesting strategic discussions with those guys. And apart from that, had a lovely weekend in the Cotswolds, understanding why it is that people who like fast cars like to live in the Cotswolds, because they are nice swoopy roads. And very pretty little villages, completely overrun by tourists, in a way that makes London look a bit quiet.
Yes, it's a very well populated part of the world with trippers from, because you don't have to go far from London and the home counties to get to the Cotswolds. And I think it's Chipping Sodbury, is that in the Cotswolds? Is that where Cameron lives and all that sort of
Chipping
thing?
Chipping Norton set, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So we were a bit further up, Stow in the Wold, which is a lovely little town. Very nice food, and got to see some falcons, and vultures. There's a fantastic, the Cotswold Falconry has an amazing collection of vultures, which they give regular demonstrations of, which is fascinating. And something of a metaphor for what we'll be talking about later on this evening. There's a segue.
I like it. Okay, Matt, so this week, something that's been exercising you is, I guess it's a theme that you and I have talked about throughout the life of this podcast and previously, and something you've been working on a little bit around how people work and where they work. And this week it's been about the difference between at work and working. You know, the idea that work being a thing you do or a place you go. It seems to have been a bit of a theme and something that you've had a little bit of discussion about this week.
Yeah, it's there's ideas have been bubbling around for ages and people that I've been talking to, and some of the minimum viable workplace stuff, I think, has fed into this as well. But just reflecting on a reasonable piece of user research that we've recently done for one of the clients, and one of the things that came back from the user research is looking at how people are using technology today was that they said that people found it difficult to be able to distinguish a connection between being able to work at home, and particularly kind of work at home on a Friday type thing, and more flexible use of office space and hot desking and not having people having their own desk. And they didn't see that as two sides of the same coin. They saw it as two completely separate and almost unrelated things. And so I've been thinking about that a bit more, and what we are exploring at the moment is the idea of this distinction between at work and working. And the little thought experiment to frame all of this is, if you imagine that you are doing whatever it is that you get paid for, and you get a telephone call, and the telephone call, you look at your mobile device, and you see it's from somebody who might be telling you something really very important, or might be telling you something completely trivial. There's a number of people. That could be a spouse, it could be a boss, the who knows what else, but the garage, what, I don't know. But the key thing is, you have a decision to make about whether you pick the phone up, and you decide to pick the phone up, and then when the other person starts speaking, you realise quite quickly that what they've got to say is trivia, and you need to get back to focusing on what it was that you were doing first. And there are two things that you might say. The first thing you might say is, I'm sorry, I'm at work at the moment, could I call you back a little later? The second thing you might say is, I'm sorry, I'm working at the moment, can I call you back a little later? It's a very subtle little difference. But my contention is, certainly in one of the organisations that I'm working with at the moment, but I think more generally in our society as a whole, most people will say I'm at work rather than I'm working. And that actually, I think, is a significant thing. It's very, very subtle, but it's very significant, because what that says is that our attitude about work culturally is embedded in the idea of work being a place you are for a period of time and you may or may not do anything there. And that the world is changing, particularly for people in knowledge worker type scenarios, and that idea of being at work is actually profoundly changing now. And that has a whole load of knock-on effects. For big organisations, it means that they want to be able to take advantage of all these things that this new technology gives them, like being able to have more flexibility of how much space they rent and where people might work and more homeworking and other things like that. But if people are still of a mindset that they are only at work when they are at work, that's going to be problematic. It's got a big impact for management and management culture, because I still see a lot of management culture that's based on the idea that you can't really be working unless you're in the office. And I think that also, that there's still very strongly an idea that working from home is still a bit of a, you're not really working then, are you? Oh no, I've got to go home and do something very, very, I need a lot of concentration for it. Oh yeah, you're washing the dog. And all of those things combined means that organisations on a particular trajectory to be able to become more digitally enabled in the way in which they operate within, one of the struggle points for them may well be coming up against individuals who are all at different stages of that journey towards the idea of moving from at work to working. And I see it even in myself. For 4 years now, I've been working outside of conventional employment. I have, for the last couple of years, not actually had a space to call my own, and I found that very difficult. I've now got my own desk in my own office at home, and I feel much more content because I know that I can come in here and I can be at work. So that's the idea, and starting to explore that with people and starting to think about, how do you help people on that journey? Is this important? What sorts of roles are actually continuing to be things that people will be paid for to be at work rather than working? We've been spending a lot of time over the last few weeks with some friends over from Australia, and the dad of the family is an airline pilot. And airline pilots, I'd say, are very much people who are paid to be at work. They are doing things whilst there, although actually quite a lot of the time they're not. They're there to be supervisory. They're there to be there in case something goes wrong. They are very much at work, even though they're remarkably mobile.
Well, I think that's a, you know, the, you're right. It is a continuing question, isn't it? Interestingly, coincidentally, when I said I was in Eastern Europe, I was speaking at a developer conference arranged by some colleagues of mine from Amdaris, who are really good, guys, a nearshore development resource, and they arranged a conference really for the developer community in Moldova, and they invited a guy called John Skeet, who's a Google developer, a bit of a guru around C#, and he was talking about that, and he started talking to his audience about the way he works and how he saw the future of software development and how it would work. So he does, he works at home a lot, but he, you know, went to the trouble of putting a, you know, kind of shed office in the garden, and he goes there and he's there all day. You know, he sees that as, you know, he needs to do that in order to be at work. And I know lots of people that do have to do that. They have to find themselves a space. I remember listening to somebody who was saying that they'd rented an office. I was talking to somebody at the same conference who, him and his wife both work from home at times, and then mobile as well. But their home is their office. But they rented an office in town, so they'd got somewhere to go. One or the other of them, if it was too noisy in the house. So that need to have a space, which is work, as opposed to a kitchen table or, you know, wherever, does seem to be still very, very alive. And as you say, a lot of workplaces are still quite down on the idea that people all just were shirking from home, as someone put it, you know, very, very, what was the, when it snowed a couple of years ago, there was one of those of his top tips that says, are you snowed in and working from home? He says, well, to avoid eye strain, remember to get up and stop watching the telly every couple of hours. That's which rang true, really.
There's definitely something in that, I think. But there's other sides of it as well. So so things like email culture and presenteeism, you get into some interesting things where often organisations will tell bosses, don't send emails at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, because what it does is it sends a message to your employees, your staff members, that you should expect them to be working at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. And that for me is the, yeah, but that all that's doing is reinforcing the idea that you work 9 to 5 in an office. And actually, you should be able to send email at 10 o'clock. The thing that we need to train people to do is to know that it's not necessarily your responsibility to answer or do anything with that email if it's received at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. But that's a whole different, you know, you've got issues there around perceptions of power, real power, the way in which we have hierarchy still within organisations, and that separation of what is work and what is not work is getting very hard for people now, and is going to get harder, and at all levels.
Well, I agree. And also the kind of expectation, well, if everybody else is working, then I should be working then. And there becomes a kind of, well, whether it's a peer pressure or whether it's something you kind of, I mean, once upon a time, I worked in a team, and we were working at home a lot of the time, because we weren't always, often all in the same place. And we had, I think, is it called Link now still, or anyway, back then it was called Link, you know, Microsoft Link.
Oh, Skype for Business, or Teams, yeah, as it's soon to be.
Whatever on earth it's called now, but it had presence indicators, so, which is great, you know. And I had, at that time, I had my desk set up at home, I had a dock for my laptop, and I had a KVM, so I could use my own computer, and I could switch over to the laptop when I needed to, and I'd put the laptop in the dock and turn it on, and I'd be on. When I was working from home, I could just flick it up and away I went. Fantastic. And I would come home at weekends, and I would often work, do a little bit of work on a Saturday morning, for example. Not very often, but it's some, you know, when you go to bed sometimes on a Friday night and you turn the things over in your head, and you go home in the morning, you think, actually, I have emails, or maybe write a bit of something that I've been meaning to do, or I can finish that spreadsheet, whatever it is, early in the morning before anybody else gets up, you know, maybe an hour, a cup of tea, it's done. It's no big deal. You know, you're not a hero. It's just, you know, just how it happens you've done it. But my computer would be sitting there, probably turned on all weekend. And because I turned off I turned off the bit where it tells you it goes away after you don't do anything for 10 minutes. So it was always green. And then I remember somebody saying to me, you've been doing a lot of work on this, Chris. I see you're working all weekend. And I'm thinking, I'm not working all weekend. but they'd seen, they'd obviously had a weekend where they'd done some work and they'd seen my little presence indicator on green all weekend. And they'd assumed that I was working, which is fantastic. I'm not sure I told them I wasn't. Just those little things, those little presence things. And as you say, I think sometimes the idea that you send an email, you know, at 1 o'clock on a Sunday is kind of a little flag of, you know, either martyrdom or heroism, say, yeah, look, everybody, I'm working, even if you're not. It's it just plays into all those terrible office politics which surround anything to do with worthiness.
Yes, I remember, it reminds me when I was in my very first job working at KPMG, second job, I think, there. And there was a programmer who was a lazy sod, and he used to turn up late every day. And this is in the mid-90s, so it was still, you know, there was no concept of flexible working. You were in at 9 and you were finishing at 5 or 6 or whenever it was. And his boss basically gave him an ultimatum, which was he needed to start coming in on time, and he needs to be in on time every morning. And to be able to prove that he was in on time every morning, he needed to send him an email at the specific time when he arrived to let him know. And of course, he was saying this to a computer programmer who just basically set up a macro so that the thing sent, and he was smart enough to even make sure that it sent at a slightly different time each day, so it was within a boundary of, you know, a margin of error, but still acceptable to look like it was real. And that kind of thing about how you know, you're being paid to be there. Still, I see companies who are using, you know, flexi time as opposed to true flexible working, whereas basically you can do your 8 hours, but they have to be done. And you get into this thing, well, actually, none of it, it's about the what you are doing and how you are, you know, what you were delivering at the end of it, not the hours you are there. But I know as well that it's so hard, especially working the way that you and I do, it's really very hard to be able to construct a deal with a client that is anything other than hours based. It's really, really challenging because you get to some sort of procurement process somewhere that says, yeah, well, what are you getting? And say, well, no, we want to know how many hours this person's going to be working, please. I think in the 4 years I've been working, I've had one pure output-based contract, which was for the big research report I did for LEF, and the output of that was the report. But that's the only one in nearly four and a half years now.
Yeah, I think I've got a slightly different one. I do have more flexibility, but I'm not entirely sure whether that's good or bad, you know, because you feel if you're there to provide hours, you know, back to your old compensation thing about, you know, you're compensated for the fact that you have to do something horrible for sometimes. And if I'm doing that, you can spend your time and you can do useful things, and you can be, you know, relatively comfortable with the fact that you've given up your time in the way that your employer, whoever that appears to be at whatever time, sees fit. But when you're delivering more in terms of outcomes, it puts a different pressure on you, because you're always thinking, is that enough? Has that piece of work, has that effort that I've put in there, is that going to end up with an outcome or is it not? And it's not always easy to know that. And when you're being paid by the hour, that risk is kind of underwritten, really. If you put some effort in and it doesn't maybe work out as well as you'd hoped, then your risk is underwritten by the employer. If you're paid on outcomes, or you're more flexible, then it's just far more easy for somebody to say, well, actually, it didn't go very well this month, did it? You know, the things we expected to achieve, we didn't achieve as much as we did. So maybe you didn't do any work. And so you're forever questioning your the value that you add. So I think it's not a panacea being paid by results in that way.
No, definitely not. And it's the There is one guy I know who runs a PR agency, and he has tried to be able to take it away from time by being able to refer to it as attention. So he has units of attention that he's going to give things. But I've done some work with him, and he was the person doing the billing to the client, and I still struggle to see how that amounted to anything but time. And I mean, the other side of it is there have been occasions where I've been paid for my time, and it's felt that maybe they're not getting a very good deal for it because they're not knowing what it is that I should be doing at that, or they're not available for it, but they've booked it out, and, you know, that, well, you've paid for me to be here and there's nothing I can do at the moment, and whose fault is that? Because you've booked me out and there's an opportunity cost there for, and that's hard as well. I find that really difficult because I definitely don't feel that you can be doing, you know, you need to try to find things to do then, but I don't want to be doing work for other clients at that point because I've been paid by, you know. All of those kind of complexities of it, I think, are quite hard as well. But ultimately, you know, what it is that organisations say they want is those outputs. And they're certainly at more commoditised ends of the market, as we'll talk about in a little bit. The paying for piecework effectively is the way that some of it is going.
Yeah, that's right. But that's where this comes down to measurement. What can you measure effectively? And where you're paid for, you know, piecework, and maybe, you know, the old fashioned sort of piecework where you make a thing, and if you make 10 things, you get paid 10 times your rate. That's fine. And then when you get to the kind of Deliveroo type thing, you know, you make X deliveries or whatever. But I've been talking about this for some time around. So because I've done a lot of work in facilities management, for example. Facilities management is they are people that look after buildings and provide services to communities in buildings, even if actually they don't realise it all the time. They, you know, is the toilet working and is the window broken and all that kind of thing. And when you get into housing and when you get into and things like hospitals, take a hospital for example. A hospital is there to make people, to cure people and to prevent illness and to kind of provide that service to the community. Whereas the FM service, and the FM service has a massive part to play in that, because if it's clean and there's less risk of infection, if there's natural light and the windows are clean, and then if the grounds are maintained, and all these things have a input on people's well-being and the way, you know, there's genuine scientific studies that say that if somebody can see a tree when they're lying in a hotel bed, they'll get better. All that kind of thing. So the way you design and manage buildings has an impact. And then, of course, if you're looking after the people in their home or in a care environment, if they're too cold, they're going to be ill. If there's damp, they're going to be ill. If they've got COPD, there are things that you do as a maintainer of building and services that matter in the wider sense. But it's very, very hard to measure them. So what happens is you draw up a contract to say, oh, you've got to do this in this time, you've got to do that in that time. And as soon as you do that, like, you know, whether it's hospital waiting times or SATs in schools and all this sort of thing, it becomes about the measure, doesn't it? We've talked about this before. And those other things that are important, but they just become luxuries. And then they don't get done because everybody's worried about the cost of everything. So I've been talking recently about FM as a social enterprise and how does that work? And I think that's a really good experiment, interesting. How do you run something in a way that has got a wider output, a wider vision in terms of what's important, what's good, and what's useful? So that's just FM, and FM, okay, is a kind of esoteric kind of side issue. But I think the same goes for people and the way you are, whether you're compensated or whether you're paid for an hour or whether you pay for output. At the end of the day, when you get into a corporate environment, where you get into somewhere where, especially also in a public sector environment, isn't it, where you've got to show that you are getting value for money for the taxpayers' pound and all of that kind of thing. If you're going to do that and you're going to do it in a consistent manner, then you end up finding measures. And as soon as you end up finding measures, you're back to the same old problem, aren't you? Mm.
Yes, the twin heads of Campbell and Goodhart raise their heads this thing about how if you set measurement, then the meaning of the measure changes and people game it. And that is interesting, actually, because if you come right back then to say, how do people get their heads around moving from the idea of work being a place you are to work being a thing that you do, the metrics at the moment in most organisations are completely stacked, towards the idea of work being the place you are, because it's easy to measure.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, and in the way I work at the moment, it's entirely possible that anybody I work with could come to me in tomorrow and say, well, look, Chris, you know, times are hard, actually. And whilst, you know, we appreciate everything you've done, it's about, I think we should call it a day for a while, and we'll give you a call, you know, next year, maybe, if things pick up. And that could happen. And I'd, you know, I'd say, oh, well, you know, fair enough. And I'd be thinking, well, you know, could I have done something differently? Could I have done something better? Maybe it wasn't my fault. Or, you know, any of these things could happen. But as soon as you get into an employment role, in terms of a proper contract, you would, you know, if that happened to you in a job, Matt, you'd be quite within your rights to say, well, why haven't you told me that I'm not meeting my expectations? Where's the meeting that we had where you said that this wasn't happening and therefore I need to improve and go through due process to be able to dispense with my services? And sometimes these things are about protection as much as they are about evil kind of minded bureaucratic unpleasantness.
Yes, and then also the nature of employment and the idea of work as a place, I think, is also intrinsically linked to the idea of job and traditional employment models. And those actually, just because I work in this different way, doesn't mean that I think everybody should. And I think it takes a certain level of you know, outlook and definitely prosperity and a whole bunch of other things to enable this sort of style to work on both sides. And the idea of everybody being thrust into the gig economy, I think, is terrifying.
Well, indeed. And something to talk about maybe next.
So possibly the biggest poster child of the entire gig economy is the online taxi brokerage service. We definitely don't employ cabbies, Gov. Uber. And, of course, Uber have been a little bit in the news over the last 48 hours or so for decisions that have been made by Transport for London. Quick recap on that is TfL have announced that they will not be renewing Uber's license to operate minicabs in London. And as a result of that, Uber have organised mass protests amongst their customer base by sticking things into the app, as far as I can tell, to say sign up with change.org. Change.org, by the way, a profit-making organisation. Not many people know that. It's an interesting time for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. There's a bunch of tech utopianism going on, there's a bunch of free market economics going on, there's a bunch of protection of workers' rights going on, there's a bunch of safety and protection of the public going on. It's a right old shitstorm, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it's stirred up a lot of really quite strong emotions on all sides. I mean, I think I can understand Londoners who have found a cheap alternative to black cabs, and you know, really, you know, nobody can deny that the Uber service and app is a disruptive force. But the idea that could be taken away has caused a lot of people to wring their hands and cry about, you know, anti innovation and things like that. And the usual suspects have accused Sadiq Khan and TfL of being sort of under the union's thumb and things like that. But I was really surprised at the kind of at the way that people just leapt to the defence of Uber. You can't have, you know, unless you've been not really interested in technology news for the last couple of years, you can't have failed to see quite what an unpleasant business it is. Just in terms of its senior management, the way it behaves, the culture of the business, it's been a crap couple of years. And if you worked at HR and Uber for the last couple of years, it would have been hard work. And they are, so the idea that then you can suddenly say, well, how can this possibly happen to these nice guys? And also the reaction of Uber, the way that they put a statement out saying this shows that London isn't open to innovation, and they started asking their, as you say, their customers to petition TfL, and it was almost like, this is nonsense. We do not accept any of this. When it's quite patent that they're a terrible, horrible business, and TFL actually needs somebody, needs to give them a kick up the arse. And I'm quite proud that it was TFL that did it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, of the what I have seen in terms of general kind of blather on the interwebs, I've seen very few people saying, I think this is terrible because I think Uber provide a super service. I've seen very few people say, I think this is terrible because I feel safe with every Uber taxi driver I'm with. Almost all of them have been, this is terrible because the problem with black cabs is they're so expensive. And this, for me, is, you know, let's say, the reason why TfL aren't or have announced that they will not be renewing contract for them to operate because they do not see them as a fit and proper company to do so because of a few things. First of all, a few very significant examples of where Uber drivers broke the law in ways involving assault and sexual assault, and Uber did nothing to be able to follow that up, as they should have done and they were duty bound to do as a result of those incidents happening. And then also there's a thing called Grey Ball, which basically can be set up, and my understanding of it is that if Uber think you're somebody from, say, TfL, they can set up Uber for your account so you don't get to see what's really going on in the way that normal customers can. So they're obfuscating away how they're operating from people who might be trying to be able to keep track of them from a regulatory perspective, which is shady. The thing for me, though, that underpins all of this is the tech utopian bullshit that goes on around this whole space. And cards on table. First of all, I've never used Uber, and I've never intended to, and I never will, because I think that they're an odious company. I don't want them to have any of my money. I also, though, live two doors down from a place that is regularly used as an Airbnb. And that's a complete pain in the arse as well, when you've got no idea who your neighbours are, one day to the next, which is just insane. And in both cases, these companies are operating. Now, I don't know as much about Airbnb's business model for Uber, though. That's an organisation that is burning about $2 billion a year. It is buying its market. It is doing it in a way that it is basically, it's a monopolistic business model. Black cab drivers can't compete because there's a great article, which I'll post a link to on the webpage later, by a group who specialise in transport news in London. It's a fantastic, detailed explanation of exactly what's been going on. And their estimate, I think, is that 41% of the cost of an Uber cab is covered by the cost that is charged to the passenger. So they're subsidising to nigh on 60% of... And they're still getting accusations of not paying people very well and being fairly sharp in terms of practice. And they also have a structure that means that they can pretty much bypass corporation tax and VAT for services that other licensed drivers would have to be charging VAT for. All of that stuff combined, and you kind of think, you know what? That's a bit sucky, really, isn't it? But it's not the reason. All of that stuff isn't the reason why TfL have called time on it, or potentially calling time on it. And on the other hand, everybody who I see who's saying, oh, Uber's fantastic, it's purely because of price. It's a pure, you know, one of the rare cases where it's a pure economic argument. It's because they're so much cheaper. And it's a false economy, because that is not an economic business model.
No, it's not. But you know that Uber, when they can, charge you an arm and a leg. A surge pricing will put the prices up when they think they can. So what's to say that when they've put all the other cab firms out of business and they've got, you know, they've got monopoly, I'm sure they won't be charging as little as they can get away with. That's not the way their business model works. The idea that they haven't put people out of business, I'm sure, you know, no doubt they have. There's the smaller taxi, you know, minicab companies that have rinsed in terms of their business model. The black cabs, you know, they've got a monopoly, and they've got not a monopoly, but they've got a protected position. And maybe that's something that needs to be sorted out. Maybe that's if that was a perfect service, and Uber wouldn't have had any room to breathe, would it at all? But like you, I mean, I've never installed it. I've never used it. I mean, they are in Birmingham, you know, and I could have used Uber, and I've, you know, clearly been traveling around London a lot in the last couple of years. I could always have used Uber, but I've never wanted to. They say they've never appealed to me as a business. But I don't think you can argue with the criteria that TfL set out about. Greyball really is. Greyball's just it's an out and out cheat. You know, it's not as nefarious as the Volkswagen exploits around the way that they cheated the diesel engines, but it's the same sort of thing. It's a way to cheat the regulation that they are meant to abide by, and kind of essentially electronically stalking public officials so that they can't use your service. That can't be something that TfL, which is pretty powerful, that's not going to be something that they're going to stand by and watch happen to them. And I applaud their stance, and I'll be interested to see what happens next, because Sadiq Khan is not he's not daft, and he'll know that this will be a very unpopular decision amongst certain part of the populace of London. Maybe anybody that's used Uber, everybody that's had a good experience, will be bemoaning this idea that they will be gone. And so maybe they will be back, but it's good to think that somebody's got the balls to tell them to up their game and stop behaving like they own the place.
Yeah, and it's the thing about actually regulations over time absolutely have to change. I've got no, regulations aren't things that are set in stone. Same way that political decisions aren't things that are set in stone. But the way to go about changing them is through the political and regulatory process. It's not just to go, screw you all, we're going to do it differently. And because we're a big tech company with massively deep pockets, screw you, which has been basically the Uber attitude. To a great extent, that seems to have been the Airbnb attitude. These business models that are actually, at the core of it, they're fairly parasitic, because they don't actually invest in anything. In Uber's case, they get half the time the drivers are having to then go through finance deals that have been arranged by Uber to third parties, and are at fairly grossy rates because the people who are applying for them are people who would otherwise be, leave banks running for the hills. And then people get locked into this usury. It's this insane setup where you have, these kind of business models are the way we lead to modern day slavery. And that's not overstating it at all. And I'm sorry if you find the cost of a black cab too much, if you find that it's too long to wait for a minicab. The too long to wait for a minicab might have been because Uber screwed that market already. And hey, in London, we've got a fantastic public transport network. Deal with it.
Yeah, I got a comment on a forum that I'm a part of when it came through. And it said that Uber are a microcosm of how our economy will sustain the new big gig paradigm. If people don't want to work for Uber, then don't. And I thought, well, that's just, that's a really short-sighted sort of technocratic comment to say that everything will be for the best when everything is unregulated and, and it's not going to be that way. If we try to commoditize people, then, as you say, we'll just end up in a very, very dark place where the only thing you're worth is your internal organs and your the strength while you have it, and then once you don't, then bad luck, everybody.
Yeah, and of course the other thing is that transport networks for the last 150 years have gone through perpetual cycles of free market and then heavy regulation, free market, heavy regulation, because they're not things that can be just left to the market, because that ain't the way this stuff works. Well, there we go. A little meander into a couple of completely disrelated subjects, but of course they are inherently linked in a clever and slightly beyond my brain way, I'm sure. For the next couple of weeks, we've got a couple of interesting events coming up. I am off, as much heralded and much trailed, for 2 days down in Bournemouth at Silicon Beach. And intention is that next week's show will basically be a audio odyssey into the experience of Matt Desmier's wonderful event. I'm just going to record lots of stuff, talk to lots of people, and then edit it into something that may or may not be coherent, but there's a lot of drinking involved at Silicon Beach as well, so it's probably going to be an accurate reflection one way or another. And then you're off to the last ever sailing of the good ship ITDF the week after.
Indeed I am, after many trips on the on those ships. I'm going to the last one. I'm actually speaking it. They run the finance directors forum alongside it on the ship, and I'm speaking on the blockchain there to bring the good news about blockchain to the finance director world. But I'll be seeing a lot of my my old friends and colleagues on the ITDF, I'm sure, along the way. At the end of an era for IT gatherings
on
the waves.
20-odd years of being on a boat sailing out into the English Channel to moor near Guernsey, and then from this point onwards, they'll be in a hotel in Watford, which, quite frankly, I can think shows you that all roads eventually do lead to Watford, or at least the M1 and the A41.
Bravo, Matt. Bravo for getting that in. And there's another one in the can. So you can catch us on Twitter at WB40Podcast and WB40Podcast.com. And you can, of course, listen to us on Stitcher or on iTunes and all other excellent podcasting services.